Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, let me grab the headphones. I'll get dialed into the studio. Get these dogs to shut up. Oh, goodness. I better close the window or the neighbors are going to get mad. Hope the guests call in tonight. I wonder if anybody's going to call in. Well, let's do this thing.
It's Rated G Radio, and this is your host, Garrett Miller.
Hey, everybody, welcome to the show. It's Rated G Radio, and for the next hour, we are going to have lots of fun. Tonight, we have the fantastic honor and privilege to have author, professor, mom, wife, humanitarian, fantastic lady, Catherine Bramkamp. She's going to be on the line with us tonight in just a second, talking about her new book, Future Girls, and all of the stuff that she's in. But just a real quick thanks to everybody who tuned in on Monday for Murray Kaufman, last night with Tarot Jeff, and then the real quick roadmap for the rest of the week. Tomorrow night we have Hollywood director, producer, writer, actor, singer. I'm not sure what else to throw in there, but he does everything. It's Mr. Sam Urban. He'll be joining the show tomorrow. And then on Friday night we have an early Friday night dance party with Colton Renard. He is an up-and-coming new singer-songwriter, and we're going to be playing his debut EP live at a very special early show at 2 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And so I hope you tune in for that and then go, like we always say, we're here to sell a little merch, so we hope you'll go buy his album. But tonight we want to talk to Catherine Bramkamp. She is joining the show live for the first time, and I'm thrilled to have you on the show. Welcome to Rated G Radio.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's great to be here with you.
Oh, my gosh. What a treat. And so for everybody, I always tell everybody the 6 degrees of separation from Kevin Bacon when I have guests on for the first time. So I had the honor to meet Catherine and her husband at a I should know this because I was there, but it was a pre-Emmy event or pre-Grammy event or pre-something event for all of these Hollywood celebrities.
It was a gifting event for the Borg 9 group. I thought I'd give them a shout-out.
Okay, so yay to the Borg 9 group. We loved everybody that was there.
The
people, you always meet different people at different events, and I was there helping Ken and Angela Downey with Downey's Desserts. As you all know, they've been on the show, and they cater to the stars and have these fantastic Downey's brownies. And so the table next to us, finally, you know, as things are starting to slow down, you know, the vendors are, you know, and that's what we were that day. We were there just kind of mulling around, and I said, well, you know, tell me about you. And Catherine's eyes just light up the room, and I'm like, where in the world did this treasure come from? And I said, if I do anything this year, I have to have her on the show. And she goes, oh, well, yeah, I'd love to do that. So anyway, that's kind of how I met Catherine. And it's been fun getting to, you know, kind of know you a little bit social media-wise, but then having you.
Yeah.
So for the benefit of everybody, so I can stop talking, because tonight it's all about you. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, how you started to become a writer and all that good stuff? Because, of course, we want to get to your new book and promote the heck out of that, but I want to find out a little bit more about you first.
Well, I am – thank you. It's so fun to have it be all about me, because I have my own podcast, the Newbie Writers Podcast, and it's not all about me. It's all about my partner, who's the newbie, and so he asks all the questions, and then I get to be the writer and answer them. So I love this format. I love podcasting and radio, so happy to be here as a guest. I consider myself an advocate for newbie writers everywhere. That's where my passion is and my emphasis is. So I work as a coach. I work as a university professor. I work as a podcaster. I write a blog, and it's all in the interest of helping people who want to express themselves creatively and want to express themselves with writing, and I help them do that. I either do it because I'm giving it away, or I do it, you know, I do it when you pay me. And it's just something that, you know, I love. Writing can be harder than it looks, but for me, it's certainly easier than cooking or knitting or certainly painting. That hasn't really panned out. So it's my art. It's the only thing I can do. And as my husband says, as a painter, you are a great poet.
Yeah, thanks. You know, yeah.
So this is what I do. And you know, like Anne Lamott commented that, you know, she tried to do real jobs and it never worked out, so she pretty much had to be a writer. And I think I'm along those lines with her. I travel, that's the other thing that I do, but I think writing is it. So have I been doing this my whole life? Yes. There are some writers who come to it late, and they do beautifully, and there's others of us who started writing stories as soon as we could pick up a crayon and scrawl it on a particular wall that was inappropriate. It's just always what I've done. I have 2 degrees in writing. I have an English degree from Santa Barbara, and I have a party on way. And I have we just lost our place as the top 10 party schools. I'm so disappointed in that.
Well, you know, we can get you to go back for another degree or something, and we'll get that title right back.
I can, I can pump it up. And then I have a degree in creative writing from Sonoma State. Yeah, my niece is there now, so I'm sure that her mother is delighted that it's not one of the top 10 party schools right now.
Yeah.
And so that's a little bit about me. I have 2 children. I have a husband. I've got a dog, you know, the usual. You know, I think for me, I like writing because that's where all the excitement goes. And my real life is pretty stable and nice, and I really like it that way.
So you can live vicariously in reality with your husband and children, but then you get to have fun writing the books. So, okay, I know you said, you know, you came out of the womb, had that Crayola, and you started writing stories on inappropriate walls. I love that description because that really is very, very colorful. But when did you really get that writing bug? Did you go through and say, you know what, I just don't think I'm going to write EMC squared. I don't think I'm going to be, you know, solving the world's ills. I think I'm going to sit here and write. How did it really find the bug in you to say, this is what I'm going to do? Because I'm always inspired by people who tell great stories. And your book right now that I'm just starting to read, Future Girls, you can tell is going to be a great story. And you're just like, oh, you just paint the pictures. And you love doing that. Did that come fairly easy for you? And what was, when did it really start?
I think easy is a rough word because I think that's not a good word to use when people are trying to write, because if they get frustrated, they think, well, you know, I heard this person on a podcast and she said it's really easy, and, you know, it's not easy. There's a lot of work involved. However,
absolutely,
I think that for the most part, and definitely for me, it's just sort of this compulsive thing that I've always done. So I've always read. Okay, so that's the other sign of a writer.
Mm.
We're voracious readers. Just, you know, if I'm out in the world, you know, doing something, traveling, 3-to-1 odds that I'm going to come back with a very big book, because that's just what I do. And my husband rolls his eyes. He's like, really? You needed a 900-page biography of Van Gogh? Yes, I did. And you're
yes, I did.
Home and your luggage. Lucky you. And he does. He's awesome. But I think part of it's the reading. So I was an early reader.
Okay.
And then as soon as you start reading, then you start saying, I want to tell my story. So I think as a little person, I was performing, I was telling stories, I was making stuff up, you know, for better or for worse. I mean, a lot
sure.
of times we have imaginary friends. So I had an imaginary friend, and the imaginary friend was doing all those bad things that I wasn't doing. And then, fortunately, my brother was born, and I could blame him.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
So I didn't need the imaginary friend. I had the real brother to just dump on. So that was really handy for me.
Oh, my gosh.
Imaginary friends, high imaginary life. And so if you have a child who is constantly telling stories or giving you this long description of what, you know, what this doll is doing or this rock is doing, or they can, or they're recounting their day that includes dinosaurs and the vulture that came in and accidentally got their homework, those are the writers. That's us. And we end up being writers, we end up being screenwriters, we end up, you know, going into film, we end up going into theater. It's pretty much our nature. And so that has always been my bent. And so if you threw a ball at me, it would hit me square in the face. I wouldn't know what the heck to do with that. So that was not me at all. I was the drama twinkie. I was, you know, sitting mournfully in dark corners, writing dark, terrible poetry. That I did all of that. And it was just always the thing that I do. And fortunately, I have a supportive spouse who says, here's your room of your own. I've always had a space to do this, and I've always really appreciated that.
So now, you obviously, you're a professional writer. I say that because you write books and you actually make money on them, which is always a good thing,
yeah.
Knock on wood. Now, but you're also a teacher. What do you do outside of your creative writing process where you're writing books like Future Girls, which we're going to talk about in just a second?
I teach at the JFK University. It's a small private university in the East Bay in California, for everybody who's not in California. And I teach critical thinking and writing, and I teach world lit. So I get those. That's so fun for me. And I love teaching the critical thinking class and the writing class because so many people don't have that background anymore where you really deconstruct what you read, you deconstruct what you're hearing, you deconstruct commercials. That's a fun unit. And I love doing that. And the more, of course, the more I teach it, the more I learn. So it's a win-win for me.
So do you have the classes that are live and in Technicolor where you actually have students face-to-face? Or are you doing any of this
yes.
over the Internet or Skype? Or
both.
Really?
Both. In the current trend now for most universities is to do, you do part of it in face-to-face, which is quite gratifying because then students can answer questions. They see me, you know, they kind of get an idea of what my personality is. You know, all of that is very important. Or you do part of it online. So they're turning their papers in. I'm giving them feedback online. I'm talking with them in forums. Most universities have these great online setups. So you go in and there's a forum and everybody can talk to each other on it. So it's very cool, and I love being able to teach remotely because, of course, then I can travel around or I can, you know, it frees me up, and I like that.
So have you had any students that have been really surprising to you? And I don't even know what I mean by surprising, but just, you know, like, I didn't see that one coming, you know, those type of moments with students.
Oh, yeah. They're great. They come up, you know, and I encourage original thought. There's no wrong answer, particularly in something like, you know, world literature where you're interpreting writing. They come up with such interesting insights, and they come up with different ways of looking at things, and I appreciate that so much, and I think that's part of my job is to nurture their approach to things and not say there's only one answer. So I've been delighted, frankly.
As an instructor that gets to see students from a lot of different places, do you find that ethnically or geographically or nationally you have students that come to you with maybe a different point of view that you are sometimes going, boy, I've never thought of it that way, or holy cow, we've got a superstar in the making?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And I appreciate coming. Most of my students at JFK are going to be close to the Bay Area, but we're very diverse up here. So, and I say that because you're down there, and I'm up here. I love the first generation immigrants, where they are most of them are very proficient in English. That's not really it. It's just their background and their experience, so they can pull from recent family experiences. Here's the Muslim, or here's somebody who just escaped, Africa, or whatever it is. I encourage them to tell their stories because they have this different insight. And one of the challenges we have with our modern culture and social media in particular is that we can really wrap ourselves in a bubble and an echo chamber and just hear what we want to hear. And so I appreciate hearing something that's different so that I can expand my thinking.
Well, let's talk about your thinking then, because you have a bunch of different stuff that you've had published. I need to understand, and so I'm glad that you're here as my guest. You like to write series books, meaning, you know, the part 1, 2, and 3, or themed books.
Yeah.
And, you know, and so like Future Girls, this will be a series as well, if I'm understanding it correctly.
Yeah.
What freedom does that give you as a writer when you write in a series, and what restrictions does that place on you at the same time?
I think one of the things I like about series, and I read them myself, so again, I write what I enjoy reading. And, you know, that's key. And sometimes, believe it or not, there's writers who say, oh, I'm going to write romances because that's where all the money is. And yes, it is. However, if you don't believe in romance books, you're not going to write a very good one. So I love mysteries with the series so that, you know, in the first book, you know, your heroine or your hero, you know, meets somebody. And then the second book, maybe they get together with that somebody. And then the third book, something happens. I love that. So I did that with my Real Estate Diva mystery series. It's a 5-book series starting with Death Provokes the Offer. And I had this character who just sprung up and took over. So just a side note, are writers schizophrenic? Yes, yes, we are. So just as a yes, I had this person in my head, and she made me tell her story. I, and that can be very exciting, a little weird. And I just told her story. I just talked in her voice. And she had all the stuff that happened, and I just went along with it, and it ended up being 5 books worth.
Wow. So, I mean, how do, from a creative standpoint, how does this person, like, come to you?
That's a great question. I don't know if any of us have, any of us where this happens, have a really good answer for that. Mine came when I was studying for my broker's license, when I was in real estate right before it all dumped off a cliff, which is why I have a 5-book series. Nothing else.
Of revolving around real estate. There you go.
Totally. So I'm reading. I'm studying for a broker's license, which I earned. And in one of the books, there was a line that says, "Death revokes the offer." And I thought, "Oh, that's the most self-explanatory sentence I've ever read." Of course it does. But then I thought, what a great title for a book. At that point, the character, the real estate agent with the big blonde hair, you know, long acrylic fingernails, big size 22 woman, her name is Allison Little, and she just appeared. And if you're lucky, those characters just appear. And you have somebody like Sir Conan Doyle, who Sherlock Holmes wouldn't leave him alone. He kept trying to kill Sherlock Holmes, and Sherlock Holmes kept coming back. It can be a little scary. Allison has been a little more well-behaved, and, you know, once the 5th book was done, she was like, okay, that was a good story, and, you know, I may not write another one about her. I think she's good to go. But she had 5 books worth of adventures.
Now, I see and I love the subtitles here. So, like, On Death Revokes the Offer, Killer Views, Dead Body in the Kitchen, Make Offer. Yeah, I mean, it's like, it's great. Or, you know, or 380 degree view, killer views everywhere you look, trash out, dream wedding, or nightmare ending. You know, so those little catchy titles like that, you're like, okay, that'll be fun to pick up and read. So typically, do you have a set format or pattern that you typically write in, like, I'm going to write 400 pages for this book, or I'm just going to tell the story, tell the stories told, this one's 200 pages, the next one's 900?
Now, that's interesting, because I think that we have, as writers, we end up with a rhythm, particularly for, like, a series book, and I shoot for 200 pages or so. I shoot for about 70,000 words, and I am an economical writer, I guess, and so I do write books anywhere from 72 to 75,000 words. I so envy people who can knock out 900 pages, you know, where they say, oh, my novel was, you know, 850,000 words, and I'm thinking, I don't have that many words in me. So that's part of it. I go for the balance, and of course, with these are mystery novels, there's definite systems, there's definite tropes. In a mystery novel, there's expectations that the reader has and that you, as a successful writer, need to meet. And so I know those, I have those internalized, and so I make sure that the novel is structured in that way.
And so, not to criticize any writer out there that writes your, you know, 3,000-page novel, but do you find that writers that do projects that are like that may be a little bit more self-indulgent about what their writing is? Or do you, I guess my question should be, is there a good 3,000-page book out there to read that you would want to read, that you would stay engrossed in? Or is it, you know, your 75,000-word book really more of the sweet spot for most of America or most anybody who reads a book?
I would say to the latter part of that question, I would say that 70,000 to 100,000 is the sweet spot for readers. Our attention spans have drastically been reduced. You know, you look at a YouTube video, and if it's 5 minutes, it's like,
oh my gosh,
so long.
5 minutes.
I don't have 5 minutes.
Yeah.
So, with that in mind, I have seen the genre field. And so when I say genre, it's the science fiction, it's the mystery, it's the romance. Those books need to be a little bit shorter. They're a little bit, it's a fast read, is what we call it, minor fast read. And that's okay, because if you write 5 books that are easy to read, then you've made 5 sales. I mean, let's be realistic about this. And if you write one great big book, difficult
made
to read,
one.
You may not make any sales at all, because someone will pick
right.
it up and say, well, that's great, but I don't have time for that. I'm going to go over here and, you know, spend my time with something I'll just enjoy that I can just, you know, read easily.
There you go.
That's
so you spend, you know, $20 on Catherine's book, or you spend, times five, or you spend $20 on one book, and, you know, there you go. And just from a business perspective, that makes total sense. I did, you know what? Until you said that, I don't think I thought about it in that context. Very smart. So, have you written anything that you? Well, and before I get to that, okay. So I want to go back here and ask. You've also written a book, Don't Write Like You Talk. What is that book about? Because the title alone makes me go, oh, my gosh, I'm a terrible writer now.
That was publisher, 3L Publishing, where they publishers were doing a series of books. One was on marketing. One was on publishing your own book. And they wanted the centerpiece, they wanted the center book to be about writing and grammar. And so when we were looking, it was supposed to be funny, and it is. It's you know, a lighter tone. And there's many, just as a shout-out, I have a number of friends who have written some really great straight grammar books, and mine is much more entertaining and funny as opposed to just saying, well, this is how you write, with an I in there or an E in either direction. So they said, do you want to write this? And I said, well, sure. You don't say no when a publisher says, would you like to write a book for us?
Right.
No. Yeah, I know, I don't feel like it. So that's what came out, Don't Write Like You Talk. And the reason that I say that is that writing is different. It's got a different tone to it. It's a different way of communication than speaking. And oftentimes when we were way back in the dark ages when we were in school, we would hear very well-meaning teachers say, oh, well, just, you know, write it like you would talk, just to get people to write. And I understand that. But
sure.
that's not what you want to keep it at. You want to write it down, write down your language or your email or whatever, the way that you would say it, and then you may want to go back and look at what that sentence structure is really doing to your meaning and to your reputation.
Very smart. And I think that is so interesting, because one of the things that I've been trying to do this year every morning, and so, you know, I'll go in great spurts for a week or two and then I don't do anything for a couple of months, is that I get up and I do what's called writing my morning pages. So before I go out and get on the elliptical or before I do anything, I sit down and just write 3 pages of whatever nonsense comes out of my head.
Mm-hmm.
And
perfect.
Just to have that done. And it is so much fun to go do. But I'll go back and read it and go, like, that's me talking, clearly. That's not me writing what's going on.
Right.
You know, so it's cathartic in a way, but it's also, okay, this is that might be a great beginning, but it's certainly not where it's going to end.
Correct. Right. No,
anyway,
I am a huge fan of both the Julia Cameron Morning Pages and Natalie Goldberg's 10-Minute Write, and it's the perfect way to start the day. You do this great dump. You get all the interesting stuff out of your head. That's where I bitch, so no one else hears it. It's really valuable. And then if you're stuck in a book, what I do is if I'm stuck in a part of my novel where I don't know what I'm doing, I think about it before I go to sleep. Wake up the next morning, just start writing, and oftentimes I'll find the answer. So that's a really great way to break through block.
I love that, and I will tell you that in the Blog Talk chat room tonight, we have Anita in Oregon, and this is just a little side note between you and me, Catherine, that Anita is not only a budding writer herself, but a published writer, and she's a very near and dear friend of me for many, many a year, longer than either of us will admit on air. But she always loves when we've got writers on, so I'm thrilled to see her in the chat room, so I just wanted to say hi to Anita. So you said that
hi,
your husband
Anita.
Has... Yeah. You have a special room that you like to write in, and we were just talking about getting up and starting the day like that. Do you have a special methodology that you use as a writer, or can you just, like, turn it on and then magically you cranked out 20 pages?
Oh, I get up every morning and write. Whether that's a list of things to do or whether that's, you know, for the newsletter or whether that's for a blog, that just depends on what's going on. But I leave... I'm like you. I get up in the morning, I write for about half an hour, 45 minutes, and then exercise and then start my day. If I am working on a novel, what I have found is that I need to create time. Like, let's say I'm going to write, I'm not good at writing between noon and 2, but let's say, you know, I sit down at 3 o'clock, I really should not talk to humans when I'm in the middle of writing a book. So I try to create it. So I've got, I say, if I start writing at 2, and I say, okay, I'll stop writing at 6. I do not interrupt me. I don't try to write and then go off to do a lecture or go off to do a class, because my brain takes a long time to disengage, to the point where my husband will call or text and say, by the way, I'm coming home. Have you? And this is his line. He's awesome. But his line is, have you thought about dinner? He doesn't assume
that's
I've
the
made
cue.
It.
Yeah.
Just have you some thoughts? Because the poor man, if I'm in the wintertime in particular, if I'm working, he comes home. The house is pitch black. The only light that's on is my computer screen in my study. The dog is like upstairs saying, I don't know who you are. And he's struggling through the house. It's like, really, really? You're just working again? It's 7. Let's move.
Yeah. Well, I like the fact that you say you just really need to be focused when you do that. Because I think that a lot of times, you know, great work happens when you aren't interrupted. And I was having a conversation today with somebody, and you know, they were talking about the fact that they got a new cell phone, and I'll spare the story, but the context of the story was, well, you know how many times when people say, you know, oh, I lost my phone, and, you know, they act like it's such a big deal, but then you say, well, you know, how was your day impacted? They go, it was lovely.
Right.
And being able to...
That's the dirty
just,
secret, isn't it?
Yeah. It's just like, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to lock myself in a room, and then when Andrew comes home and the dog might know who he is, then, you know, I might have thought about dinner. I don't know. So I love the story that you tell about just committing to it, because it is hard, you know, to get into that zone. And when you're in the zone, it's like, don't bug me, you know?
Yeah, and I do try to be really good about that. I had a moment when I was traveling with my mom and a group of friends, and I had this great idea for the third Future Girl book, Future Run. And, you know, we were up in the Arctic Circle on this cruise. I call it Hurtengurten, which is so wrong. But anyway, it's this really cool cruise up on the very, very top of the world. And I needed time. I thought, I need to write this, you know. But what do you do when you're traveling with a parent and my mom is like right there in my face. I can't work with her just staring at me. Never could.
Right.
So I volunteered to do the laundry. Okay, there's ways of getting around this kind of stuff. So I went down. So I'm in on the fourth deck of the cruise. My mother is up there talking, I'll do the laundry. I'll do this big sacrifice, right? Well, you have to babysit it when you're in a public space. So I sat down. No one is around because they're all, top of the boat. And I wrote, 13 pages of outline for the book. It was delightful. No one was going to bother me because I'm babysitting the laundry. So just for people who are parents or for writers who, you know, you want to get away, you know, quote, get away to do something, write in your car, volunteer to do the laundry, and then just sit in that nice, you know, you have that nice noise, ambient noise.
Mm-hmm.
Knock it out there. There's ways of escaping so that you can really concentrate. No one's going to bother you because who wants to do the laundry?
Who wants? Right.
And it was great. It was really funny. I'm just like, oh, this is wonderful.
Okay, so if I ever travel with you and your family, and I'll say, Catherine, what are you guys doing? And you say, I'm going to go do the laundry. I know what you're really doing. You're going to be knocking out 13 pages of outline. Okay, there we go.
Yeah.
Beautiful.
And it's always my mom. If I'm traveling with Andrew, I mean, he's awesome. And you know, if I say, you know, I'm just in this moment, he just leaves me alone, and he'll protect my time. And, you know, he's a pretty good sport about it, although at some point he'll shake me off and say, hello, I'm here. I'm in the room. Billy, who are you?
Who are you again? Exactly.
Yeah,
so,
he
tell
hates
me,
Nana. Yeah, for that reason. Who are you? Where are you?
So let's talk about Future Girls, because I'm going to totally go off on your travels, because I want to talk about that. I want to talk about some advice that you give to writers who are out there and all of that. But I'm going to save that for the last quarter section of the show here. And let's talk about Future Girls, because I'm reading the first, I don't know, the 8-9 pages of this tonight before the show starts. And I'm like, I can see everything
awesome.
That's happening here. And I'm like, oh, my gosh. So I was in between you and me in a lamppost. I was like, can we just start the show at 8? Because I'd really like to read another hour. But everybody's tuned in, you know, getting ready to tune in at 7, so I couldn't do that. So I know what I'm doing tonight after the show's over. I'm going back to Charity and Charity's plight in this new world.
Awesome. Thank you. And then if you would, write a review for me December 1st when it launches, because that's my big thing right now, is to launch it. So what do you want to know? Should I just give a little background of the book?
Tell us how you came to write The Future Girls, the first book, and then the story behind it, I guess. And then tell us a little bit about Charity and what Charity's going through as she's going through this particular event.
Future Girls came to me when I was it was a confluence of a number of things. I was interested in what small gestures, what small things happen in our current world and in the past that made enormous sweeping changes in the future. You know, I read history. I'm a casual scholar of 19th century history, and that piece of it really fascinated me. It's like, what could someone change and change everything? I also am a huge fan of Back to the Future, which is, I think it's like one of the, it's almost a perfect film in its narrative. And I like how you can go back in the future, you know, back to the future and change something. So that was also inspirational. And then I wanted to create a dystopic future. I'm a fan of Margaret Atwood, and one of her best novels is The Handmaid's Tale. And so I wanted to create like a dystopic kind of what would happen if all of those weird Mormon cults, you know, where all the women are in baggy dresses and, you know, they have their, you know, heads covered. So it's kind of combination Mormon-Muslim, if you will. What would happen if that was the norm? And then I expanded that, and I said, all right, let's say that the Internet, and I call it the reality cloud, but, you know, your whole virtual reality is so pervasive that that's where everybody is all the time. You know, it's kind of like if you've ever watched Star Trek and you have, you know, they have the hologram sickness where people don't want to get out of the hologram. Well, that's what I thought. I thought, what happens if they don't want to leave? What if the men, and what if they decided that the men are going to be the ones who get to play in the reality cloud, and they leave the women to deal with increasingly diminishing, diminishing resources. And so that's where I set this up, for the women are dealing with this real world that's kind of crappy. They don't have any power. The men have all the power. And so the women, and I will all give a little bit away because I don't want to ruin it for you, but the women decide that it's up to them to change things. And so Charity is part of that change. And so she inadvertently goes, and you'll love the adventure for how she gets to finally time travel, but she ends up being a time traveler.
I just got goosebumps when you said that.
Yeah. So she goes back in time. And what I did, I cheated. Okay, just so everybody knows, for this book, I cheated. So should we go from 2145, which I made up, to 2045, which I could still make up. So I didn't have, I decided to do future to future so I wouldn't have to, like, have anybody write me and say, you know, that really didn't happen.
That didn't happen. Right. It's a book. I could take it. You know, I'm the writer. I can make anything up. So, yeah. So I was going to ask,
story. So that's her story.
How did you pick 2145? Because I like how you call this the Great Convergence of 2045, when all the religions joined together so peace, organized through the reality cloud, could reign.
Yep.
How brilliant is that sentence? I'm just like, oh, my gosh.
Okay.
But how did you pick 2145? Is it just like, yeah, that sounds like a good date?
I was working in round numbers, so I had 2145, and then I thought, well, let's just shoot her back 100 years.
Okay.
And she has 100 hours. You know, just kind of, I wanted round numbers. I wanted it to be a little bit in the future, so that I could, just enough so that I could work with, like, Moore's Law and, you know, the physical world that we have now and extrapolate that forward. So that I could create, you know, I could manage that. You know, I was reading articles about technology. I was consulting with physicists and saying, oh, you know, what is possible, what is not possible. That, you know, 2045 was something that I could get a grip on, and I do San Francisco in 2045. The funny thing about this was I had a number of beta readers. That's the new thing that writers do. It's the way I think I finish a book and I send it off to about a dozen people, and then they read it and come back and say, you know what, this worked, this didn't work, you got to change that, and it makes a big difference in the quality of manuscript. So I had my podcast partner, who is an engineer and an AV expert, that's what his business is, he writes me and he says, all right, you need to build a time machine. You have to build a time machine. So then she goes on the time machine, and that's how she travels. I said, okay. Then I get my son, who is a physicist with PhD in physics, and he writes me and says, whatever you do, don't build a time machine.
Oh! And I'm sure, now, what was his compelling reason for not doing it?
He had, well, the kid won. He had much more compelling reasons for not building a time machine. He said, look, there, you'll be in a world of hurt because you will have people all over you saying, well, this is possible, this isn't possible.
Oh.
It's not possible. It's not possible yet. You can't send people. I'm good with going in the past, but I'll go along with him on sending people into the future. So, I'll go with that. You can only go in the past. And so I said, okay, no time machine. But I do believe especially in spaces around the United States, we have spaces of convergence. We have spaces that are, for whatever reason, sacred, and I'm playing with that. So in the next book, the sacred spaces are on, there's an East Coast one, and the future run, the third book, there's sacred spaces in the Black Hills. You know, so they exist, and I'm going to exploit that.
And so can you tell us a little bit more, or tell us a little bit about Charity, who's looks to be the main character for Future Girls here?
Yes. She is 18 years old. She has two younger sisters. She sees, just like any 18-year-old, she sees what her mother is doing. You know, her mother is working there. All of the food is done through replicators, and all the replicators are, their base food is based on corn. So a lot of corn syrup. Everybody's really fat.
Okay. And that, I haven't gotten to that part yet. I was wondering why are all the women like heavies, you know, here? And I didn't.
Because their food is based on crap, basically.
Okay.
But Charity's mother has dirt food. They call it dirt food if you have a little garden. You try to fresh food. So they call it dirt food. And so, and Charity's thinking, damn, this is like so not working for me. You know, she's 18. Her mother's, their parents are going to marry her off to somebody, and she's going to have the same life. She can see it. There's no change.
Yeah.
And the only thing that keeps her going is that they exchange. She's part of a group of girls who exchange books, even though you're not supposed to read.
Mm-hmm.
They exchange books because if you have a reality cloud, if you have everything electronic, you can control what comes at people.
Mm-hmm.
If you hand around books, you can't control it as much. And I think that's something else that's interesting. All this idea of Amazon being able to pull back books that you thought you had on your Kindle or on your iPad, and they're like, no, we changed our mind, we took it back. That's fascinating.
Really?
You know,
they can do that?
Yeah. Now, I don't know, I think there was a lawsuit about it, but yeah, they were actually pulling books back off of people's machines. Fascinating, right? I mean, for a writer, you're like, oh, God, that's so Orwellian. I can hardly stand it. Let's look at that.
Right.
So Charity knows a little bit about what she should want. There's no way to get it. You know, there's no way, she can't get out of her city. There's no place for a young girl to go. She can't go to the reality club. That's just for boys. So what does she do? And that was what was interesting to me. She gets thrown into a completely different situation, and she has to figure it out. She has to, just like any good heroine, she gets to grow, and she gets to learn about herself and have that adventure and learn from everybody who she meets and everything that she experiences.
And I think what I liked most about the first few pages that I'm reading here tonight was that until you told me the year was 2045, I was honestly in my head thinking it's like 1845 or 1895 or something like that. Because the communities and the world in which you're painting, you're like, oh, this is so backwoods, or this is so 1845. You're like, this can't be 2045. And then when you tell me that, now I'm really interested because you're like, what's happened here in 30 more years that we're going to be like this?
Right. And, remember, she's in 2145, so she's
right.
100
so it's even 100 years past.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I was like,
so you think
what?
About what was, and I thought about, you know, what happens if, you know, our resources disappear? What happens if we're, you know, we continue on a trajectory of climate change? All those things is what I kept in mind. And we do revert back. I mean, if you think about how sophisticated the Greek and Roman cultures were, and then when they had their, when they shrunk, we had the Dark Ages. I mean, you know, people went back to those smaller villages. They went back to that smaller way of staying organized.
Well, and we're not going to talk TV tonight, but there was a show on NBC last year called, I think it was Evolution or Revolution or something, and it ended up being like a season and a half. But it was after a big electrical something or something happened, and electricity was taken from the world. And how do you have society when you how do you do it? So fascinating, but
I mess around with that with the second and both the second and the third book.
So how far along are those? Are they done? Are they in the can, or are they still processing?
Future Gold is with Eternal Press. So they took it, and I don't have a date on release. We're going to release Future Gold first. But, yeah, the second book is ready to go, which I'm pretty excited about. And that is set in that heroine goes back in time to 1861 to the gold rush in California.
Oh, my gosh.
And so that's what she needs to change. And that was very fun to research and mess around. And I've had a lot of fun with that book. And then the third book, Future Run, is what I'm working on right now. And I may try to knock out a chunk of it during November, during National Novel Writing Month. But we'll see how that goes. But I'm already working on that.
That is fun. So, I think I need to be like the Southern California president of your fan club or something like that because
I would love that. Please.
Okay, so I'm going to make up a T-shirt tonight, and the next time I see you and your husband, I'm going to ask you to autograph to make it official. But as we have just a few minutes left, we've got about 15 minutes left in the show. Everybody, you need to go out and get Future Girls, so we have that, so I can make sure that we've talked about that. Can you talk about your Newbie Writers website and all the cool stuff that you do there?
Sure. We 2 years ago, we started, my partner and I, Damien both, started Newbie Writers Podcast. We have never met. He wanted to do a podcast just as a creative outlet for him, and he wanted to learn more about writing. He's working on a fantasy novel. And he put a shout out in a newsletter that I get, Newbie Writers, and he said, I want to do a podcast. And I, at that moment, it was like that week, I said, oh, I'm going to do a podcast. Sure. And so
sure.
Really. It's amazing when you say that, what happens, right? So he's in Australia. He lives in Adelaide. So we Skype. That's how we have to do it because we can't do it by calling. And we hit it off. We just hit it off. And he's super cynical, and he's the newbie writer. And you know, if I get a guest on and we talk about romance or we talk about marriage, he will just, you know, light into us. And it's very funny. It's very entertaining. And we've been doing it. We do it every Friday. We've been doing it for 2 years. And it's going beautifully. I really enjoy it. And like yourself, you know, I just say to people, hey, I have a podcast. You want to come on? And when you say, sure.
Sure. You know, okay, let me ask you this. So if we can talk about, you know, like horror stories of guests, and I've only had one, and I don't know if this happened but when we had met or not, but I'll share the story with you in the most general of terms because I always want to encourage people to come back. But have you had any disasters as a guest or having guests on your podcast? And what do you do to combat what you feel is already a sinking ship?
Oh, one of the advantages that we have is that there's two of us. So when we have a guest, you know, then there's three, and we're good together, and so we can listen. If the guest is going on and you know, he or she are like they're rocking and rolling, we get to step back a little bit and just, you know, feed it, just as you know. You know, like ask them more questions and get them going. We've had a couple of guests where it was like, oh, you've written a book, and they say, yes. And
you're like, okay, help me out here.
Okay. Yeah. So, and we've had a few of those. And, you know, sometimes you book people, you haven't really vetted them. You just say, what the heck,
yeah.
Let's just go.
Yeah.
And so we just, you know, he'll get online. He'll, you know, he'll rattle about it and says, well, I see on Amazon that your book is doing this. What do you have to say about that? And we just will start talking to just save it. So, and we also have we have bits that we do. So we have, like, tortured sentences. You'll hear when you're on our show. We have tortured sentences that I pull from my students because they are so productive in that range. Tortured sentences, we have word of the week. We do some standard things. And so that also can be, you know, we can use that to shore up. As we
go
along, if the guest's not that talkative. Yeah, so we sort of have a fail-safe. And then sometimes I have guests who don't show up. And at that point, then we say, okay, and I have subjects that I can just pull, and we just talk about it between the two of us.
Okay, I guess, and I've been very fortunate in the 2+ years that I've been doing this, I've never not had a guest show up, and
that's,
you know,
awesome.
Everything has
good.
Always been. I know. I say knock on wood, you know, because tomorrow night could be
yeah.
a different story. that would just astound me that you have somebody booked as a guest and they don't show up. But I suppose statistically, it has to happen at some point.
One of our challenges is that we deal with up to 3 time zones. And so sometimes that can be the problem. So getting somebody on the East Coast is particularly difficult for us. So the East Coast is like the middle of the night. I'm in the afternoon in California, and then Damien's the first thing in the morning the next day. So that's one of our
absolutely
we've lost because of that. Yeah, yeah, and so, we very rarely see Europe because of the timing.
So do you have regular listeners that tune in and are
mm-hmm.
you know, kind of like your fans that were there every Friday, you know, rain or shine? Or I mean, how do people find out about your podcast? Let's plug your podcast here, by the way.
Well, thank you. Our podcast is free on iTunes, and we have a core group. They come on the Google Hangout when we record. We don't record exclusively through Google Hangout. Damien's got the boards and everything, which I love. He does all the work and then yells at me if my mic doesn't work. It's wonderful. I do the scripts and he does the tech. It's a great system. We have great, you know, solid listeners, and you know, we always want to expand. So come on down and listen to us. And Garrett's going to be on our show on Halloween. So
Halloween, I can't wait.
For that. Yeah,
yeah, that'll be way fun. I'm going to be dressed up,
and then
you'll know.
Find out how weird my podcast partner is.
I can't wait. And so, you know, my homework between now and Halloween is to go back and listen to some of the archived episodes or on what do you call your old episodes? I call mine on demand.
We just call it there. You can go on our website and you just scroll through. We'll have episode. You know, Damien says this episode. Sometimes I name him by my guest, and then he comes up with something more clever than that.
Oh, cool. Okay. Well, that's fine.
Yeah.
So I just think that one of the things, if you have like a fun podcast, is, you know, especially if you get somebody to listen once, then you're like, oh my gosh, I've got to go back and listen to Catherine's podcast again. And so then you start building, you know, people that want to listen on a regular basis.
Right.
And,
right.
you know, when you have great content like you do, then I think it's like, this is must listen podcasting at its best. So I'm always fascinated when people do something like what you're doing and how you grow and build your fan base. So that's really cool to hear. Let's see here. We have I talked about where you write, and then your husband doesn't find you. What about advice for writers who are struggling to find their voice? Do you have any advice for people who just say, you know what, I know I have to be a writer, but you know, I just can't think of anything to say?
There's more of that. There's more of that than anything else, isn't there? Or the ones who say, my favorite is, I had a really interesting life, I should write about it. I just got to say, for the most part, you probably don't. And that's why I make up stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
My life is not that interesting. It's not that dramatic. It may be interesting, but there's no, oftentimes, if you're lucky, there's no drama. I feel badly for people who have drama.
It's totally the case.
Yeah. So one of the things that you need to do is do just what, you know, Garrett and I do, and you get up in the morning and you flip and write. And sometimes people don't realize that that's fairly key. you have to get up, or you do it at lunch. I have a friend, Carolyn Jewett, who writes bodice ripper romances. She writes in her car at noon. She has a full-time job. From 12 to 1, she sits in her car and she writes her book.
Oh,
so you have to be fairly determined.
That is awesome.
I know. Isn't that amazing? And she does, and she's doing really well. Write for love, not money, because it's going to take you a really long time to get the money. So do it for love. The writers who are successful are the ones who just keep doing it. And it's not like anything else. It's not like sales, where you get a great sale and then you get money and then it's like, woohoo! It's like you write something really great and you get 13 rejections. That's what it looks like. And you have to be pretty tough and pretty determined to stick with it. But it can be done, absolutely. And people surprise the common wisdom all the time. So if you have a great idea and you want to get it out in the world, do that. Don't let anybody stop you, and don't let anybody say, well, that's not commercial, or, oh, no one will buy that. No one knows. They're all lying. They have no idea what's going to sell.
No clue.
We're always surprised, and that's what's fun.
So can we talk business for a second? Since you're talking about, like, writers write always, I got that line, I think, from Throw Mama from the Train with Danny DeVito and Billy Crystal, writers write always, and I don't know why that just came to mind, but you're saying, get up and write, just, you got to do it. So if, for somebody who's doing a book themselves for the first time and they say, you know what, I've written the great American novel, I guarantee it, I've just got to get it out there. What are your thoughts on self-publishing or, sending a manuscript or a CD or an email with your book attached to it to, 20 different publishers? What are some of the strategies out there to find ways to get your stuff published?
There's a whole bunch. I think one of the really fabulous things about the industry right now is that it's like the Wild Wild West. Self-publishing has come a long way since I started in 2001, 2002. It's come a long, long way. And so if you want to make money, if you want to control your product, self-publish the book. There's a lot of work that goes into that. I have a client who is very successful. She's making lots and lots of money, and she controls all of her books. She publishes them through CreateSpace. She's rocking and rolling. You go through a publisher, like I did with Future Girls. A publisher will help with editing. They had professionals to help with the cover that, I didn't have to pay up front, but they'll get their money on the back end, so I won't see, until I pay off the cost of the book, I won't see any income. That's fine. Small publishers aren't giving you advances, so that's changed too. It's a longer sell cycle. So it took almost a year for me to get Future Girls out. If I published it myself, it would have taken me a month. So you look at,
wow.
You have to look at, yeah, you have to look at what your anxiety level is or how much control. Many authors are going to self-publishing so they could control their product. And in fact, in the Real Estate Diva mystery series, I had one book, the middle book in Good Faith, was with a publisher. And I wanted to move the books. I wanted to do a giveaway on Kindle. I wanted to do KDP Direct. There's all sorts of things I wanted to do. But I couldn't with that one book. I had this middle book in the series that I couldn't do anything with. I'm just getting it back. And I'm thrilled. So you have to think, it's a different game now. And the quote, the stigma of being, quote, self-published, oh, you're just self-published, it's not as legitimate anymore. I think more authors feel that way about, I think more authors lay that on them than a reader. A reader doesn't care who published the silly book. They care about whether or not you made a good story.
Okay, and then my last question, I might have two or three more, but my last question of the night, I'm officially going to say.
And then I have an offer for your listeners, so don't let me forget that.
Oh, yeah, we've got to make sure we talk about that too. So, okay, I just got goosebumps. I love having you on here. You could be on, like, every night.
Of course.
You do it every week. Okay, so So my question for you, now that you've got this great American novel, whether you're self-published or you go through a publishing house or whatever,
uh-huh.
How important is it that your artwork on the cover is attractive?
It's not important at all if you're sending it to publishers, because they'll create something for you.
Right.
If you're doing it yourself, okay, so if you're self-publishing, You hire a graphic designer, and I speak from deep, deep experience with graphic designers on their knees saying, please, please stop doing it yourself. Because apparently they're not good.
Yeah.
So what you want to think about is that your cover really does help sell that book. And you need a cover that will translate not only in a format, you know, your 6x9 format, you also need it to sell in a tiny little thumbnail when it's stuck up there on Amazon. And that is critical. So you want to have something that really depicts what the book is all about. And you know, we could do a whole show on how to manage your covers and what needs to go in it. But if you go on my website, and go on the yourbookstartshere.com and you look under Future Girls. I have the two covers that I was suggesting that the graphic designer came up with, and finally the graphic designer got totally disgusted with me, came up with her own cover and said, "All right, how about this?" And I looked at it and I said, "That's awesome. It's nothing I thought of."
Yeah, yeah. And there you go.
Which just goes to show you, I am not the graphic person. I am the writer.
Well, you know, I was talking to a friend of mine last week who is a musician, and he is finally getting some acclaim and some recognition from people who have the opportunity to elevate a career. And we're sitting down having lunch, and the conversation came out, and he goes, "You know, Garrett, at the end of the day, I just want to sing my songs, I want to write my songs, and I want to be the artist. I don't want to have to deal with, you know, coming up with my album cover work. I don't want to have to worry about,
right,
you know, balancing the water." And I think that translated into being a writer, too. The writer just wants to tell their story. You don't have to think about,
yeah,
oh, now I've got to, like, come up with a cover art. Now I've got to think about, I just want to write my story. Don't make me think about all the other stuff. So.
Oh, anyway. And the really bad news is once you write that, the writing is the best part. After that, you have to market the silly thing. So then you have social media. Then you have Facebook. Then you have Twitter. And it's very difficult for writers because, for the most part, if a really intense writer, you're really happy in a dark room,
right,
writing away. And when someone drags you out, I was at a library panel, and I was sitting next to a writer. I mean, there was four of us at the table, you know, talking about writing. And she leans over at one point, and she said, "God, I really hate these." And I looked out and I thought, There's 12 people. This isn't even a big deal.
Right, right. Oh, my
goodness.
And she
just, absolutely not what she did. And I just thought, it does help stock, I'll say.
She's in the, you have to do that. It's just part of the nature of the game.
Yeah.
You know? So,
yeah, it is.
So let's talk about the offer that you have for listeners here tonight.
I have this great idea. Okay, I'm so glad you started reading the book and you like it. Thank you. I really appreciate that. So my offer for your listeners, if you guys email me at bramkamp, BRAMKAMP, at yahoo.com, if you email me and say, "Hey, I'd love to read the advanced copy of Future Girls," I will send it to you.
You can't beat that.
If you want to get
cool
on the bandwagon, I will send it to you. Write me a review. I'll remind you when the book comes out in December. But I would love to have this out and get some buzz going about it. So just you, if it's two people, if it's 10 people, if it's 100 people, I will send you that advanced reader's copy.
Okay, Catherine, one more time, where do they email? And I'm going to put it in the chat room and I'll also
email me at Bram. Yeah, and you'll post it. But at Bramkamp, BRAMKAMP, at yahoo.com.
It's easy. Okay, so I'm going to make sure I blast that after the show as well. And then Gail
Thank
Carline,
you.
Who is a author down here in Southern California. Do you know Gail Carline, by the way? If you don't, you need
no.
to. But if okay.
Okay.
So she writes series books as well. She's been on the show. She's actually in the Blog Talk chat room, and she just piped in about the conversation about the book signings and the events. She goes, "Something must be wrong with me. I love to come out of my cave and do meet and greets."
Good for her.
I know.
That's how you become successful. Absolutely.
There we go. Anyway, Catherine, it has been a huge honor and a pleasure to have you on the show tonight. Any last words of wisdom before we take it out?
Just if you're writing, if you want to write, your first step is to do it and have a lot of confidence in what you're doing. Everybody has a story, and everybody has something interesting to say. And I believe that we should all be saying it. We should all be writing.
There we go. That's awesome advice.
There you go.
Catherine Brenkamp, thank
you for
being on the show.
Me.
And I will see you, I'll see you on social media beforehand, but I'll see you on Halloween. And for everybody else, we'll be live tomorrow night with Hollywood director, producer, singer, actor, you name it, award winner, Sam Ervin. He'll be joining us tomorrow night live for a special full hour of Rated G Radio. And then again, 2 p.m. on Friday, early Friday Night Dance Party, Colton Renard comes on to play the world premiere for his new EP, and this is the closest I'm going to come to a book song. I always end the show with a song, but it's Tell Me Something Good by Rufus. So as a writer, you want to tell us something good. Everybody, we'll see you live tomorrow night.
Listening to Rated G Radio.